From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Jeff Selden, VOA National Security Correspondent. Our topic on this edition of the program, efforts to defeat the self-proclaimed Islamic State, or Daesh, in Iraq and Syria. Our guest, Nuseiba Yunus, Senior Research Associate at the Project on Middle East Democracy. That's a policy group based in Washington. The focus of her research is Iraqi politics and the rise of Daesh, as the group is known in Arabic. Nuseiba Yunus has just returned from Iraq and will share her insights regarding progress and obstacles to defeating Daesh. Her principal argument is that the United States will not defeat ISIS or Daesh unless the core political grievances that lay behind its rise are addressed. In numerous opinion editorials and articles, Yunus argues that political counterinsurgency, which was initially at the core of U.S. efforts against Daesh or ISIS, has been increasingly overshadowed by U.S. military engagement. In addition, she underscores the need for the creation of a Sunni National Guard force to retake and hold territory from ISIS. But the creation of this force is being stalled by the Iraqi parliament. Ms. Yunus previously worked as a research fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University, and she has worked extensively on sectarianism in post-war Iraqi politics. Her recent opinion editorial in the Wall Street Journal, entitled "To Defeat Islamic State in Iraq, Bridge the Sunni-Shiite Divide," caught my attention and compelled me to invite her to be our special guest on Press Conference USA. And Nuseiba Yunus joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague Jeff Selden.
My pleasure.
Well, Nuseiba, you have written extensively that the counterinsurgency effort in Iraq does require much more than guns. And while you do laud the transition from the divisive previous Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki to Haider al-Abadi, you say that he is still not doing enough to reach out to Iraq's Sunni community to address corruption in the military, in the judiciary, and to actually jumpstart this Sunni National Guard. Now, based on your recent trip, do you still stand by these observations, or have things changed?
Yes, absolutely. I spoke to a number of influential Sunni leaders on my trip, both in Iraq, but also in Qatar and in Turkey. And something that really unifies these voices is a sense that the Iraqi government, though Prime Minister Abadi is well-intentioned, is simply not delivering on its promises to really reform Iraqi politics so that Iraqi Sunnis feel that they have a real stake in the future of Iraq and feel that their future in Iraq is protected. And ultimately, as much as we hear about these small Sunni tribal forces joining the fight into Crete, for instance, or in other instances, these are tiny, tiny numbers. When we look at the Sahwa back in 2007...
The so-called awakening.
Yeah, the awakening movement, which is when the United States empowered Sunni tribes to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. There we're talking about over 100,000 Iraqi Sunnis taking up arms against al-Qaeda, and that was successful. And now we're seeing maybe something in the region of 5,000. I mean, the numbers are really a fraction of what we've seen before. And the underlying grievances of Iraq's Sunni population have not yet been effectively or credibly addressed. And the longer that the Abadi government goes on without addressing those core grievances, the more he loses the credibility and the goodwill that he had built up when he replaced Prime Minister Maliki. And I think this is really a subject of the utmost urgency and is really missing from the way in which we talk about the success of our forces defeating ISIL here in the United States.
How do you define the Sunni grievances?
Well, I mean, there are so many, but the core grievances really relate to the imprisonment, arrest, torture, and conviction of Iraqi Sunnis on terrorist charges without due process. So it's a bit of a vicious circle, really, in that you have terrorism emerging from the Sunni community, and then you have Shiite-dominated Iraqi forces going into Sunni towns and villages and just doing these random sweeps in which they arrest a bunch of Sunni men, or when they can't find the men they're looking for, they'll arrest some women who are related to them. And the Iraqi judicial system really relies on confession. I mean, they don't make any attempt to do forensic examinations. They don't do serious investigations. They basically torture people into confessing. And so you end up with thousands of wrongly convicted Sunnis in prison, or even on death row, on terrorism charges, who have had nothing to do with any terrorist activity. And that fuels such a sense of being unfairly targeted, of being the subject of a witch hunt, and of Sunnis really feeling vulnerable and unsafe around Iraqi security forces. And that's one of the core grievances that Sunnis talked about again and again when you had these mass Sunni protests in 2013. And the Iraqi government has ultimately done very little to address this.
Now, quickly, before I turn to my colleague, Jeff Selden, based on your conversations with members of government over there in Iraq, first, does Prime Minister al-Abadi recognize these grievances, and does he recognize that it's ultimately the political process which will defeat Daesh, ISIS, ISIL? And if so, what are the impediments at the Iraqi political level?
I think we're in actually quite a rare situation in Iraq where we have a progressive and genuinely visionary leader. I mean, Prime Minister Abadi, by all accounts, is aware of these grievances and has been trying to push reform through the cabinet and to introduce new legislation to the Iraqi parliament. The problem is that we have such a broken sense of community in Iraq and such tension between Iraq's Shiite and Sunni communities that we're seeing Shiite political leaders block any attempt to introduce these political reforms in parliament. And ultimately, these Shiite political leaders are representing Shiite constituencies who don't want to see any concessions given to Iraqi Sunnis. You know, they see these Sunnis often as terrorists, as people responsible for the mass murder of their sons who've been involved in fighting Daesh. And the idea that you give these people concessions at a time like this, when emotions are really heightened, I mean, it's unpalatable and it's very politically challenging. And it would require these political leaders to really follow a long-term vision for how Iraq can actually be repaired at the expense of potentially their short-term political popularity and success.
It was interesting. A moment ago, you talked about the fact that PM Abadi had some goodwill when he came in, and that time seems to be running out. At the same time, there's this massive animosity between Sunnis and Shias on the ground. So even if more was pushed politically, is there enough will to take care of the ground-level mistrust and, in some cases, the ground-level violence that is taking place on a day-to-day basis? You mentioned some of the sweeps that the military or police do, rounding up Sunnis. We've also seen online brutal videos put out by the Shia militias, sometimes even the Iraqi security forces, one which even purported to show a 9- or 10-year-old boy assassinated because he was suspected of aiding the Islamic State or Daesh.
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting on a really important point here. As long as you have Shiite militias and Shiite-dominated security forces leading the fight against Daesh, you might get some short-term successes, but ultimately you are not going to eradicate Daesh from Iraq in the long term. The Iraqi Sunnis have to be responsible for A, getting Daesh out of their communities, and B, for securing their own areas so that the people who live there genuinely feel safe and secure and feel like the security forces who are there are able to discriminate between them and able to tell the difference between a moderate Sunni and an extremist, and who have their best interests at heart, which is why the US has been pressuring Abadi and the Iraqi parliament to put together a Sunni national force. But the other thing that's important, you know, we do have some natural separation in terms of the territory that's dominated by Sunnis as opposed to Shiites. Of course, there are some mixed territories as well. But for those areas like Mosul and Ramadi and just generally the Anbar province and parts of Salah ad-Din, we should be offering Sunnis a future in which they have a huge amount of autonomy.
How more complicated is this, given the involvement of the Shia militias and, as a result, the involvement of Iran and the constant pressure that comes from Iran, which seems to be playing up the sectarian divide?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely complicated. Once you have Iran involved, and you have Iran involved at a time when the Sunni Arab world in general is extremely nervous about the growing level of Iranian influence across the Arab world. Iraqi Sunnis, but also the Sunni Arab governments they're talking to in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, all of them feel this real sense of fear and panic about the level of Iranian influence in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, and now in Yemen as well. And I think there's a sense definitely amongst Iraqi Sunnis that if Daesh is defeated, then Iran is simply going to take over their areas. And I think the analysis of Iranian involvement is often oversimplified and sometimes even verging on the paranoid. Ultimately, we are seeing organic Shiite Iraqi popular mobilization forces have emerged because Shiites feel under attack. But Iran has been able to take advantage of those grievances, has been able to offer support and technical guidance, and has been able to increase the effectiveness of these forces. And so, of course, has been welcomed in large by Shiite militias. But yes, you're right. It does raise the stakes of this game. It raises the extent to which regional powers see this in terms of a proxy struggle rather than seeing it in terms of a local population that's bitterly divided and needs to be reconciled.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Nusseibeh Yunus. She's a senior research associate at the Project on Middle East Democracy. That's a policy group based here in Washington. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, along with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a very faithful listener and a Facebook fan, Anayatullah Zareh, from the mostly Persian-speaking city of Herat, Afghanistan. And happy Nowruz to all of our listeners who celebrate this festival of spring and the new year. Well, back to you, Nusseibeh Yunus, to talk about what is holding up the creation of a National Guard, a Sunni National Guard, which you argue would go a long way to help diffuse the tensions and give the Sunnis a way to buy into defeating Daesh in a much more inclusive way. What are the impediments to the creation of this force, which I would imagine all sides, Shia and Sunni and even the United States, argue is a good thing?
So I think one of the big problems that we're seeing is that Iraqi Shiite militias and also to some extent the Iraqi army have been feeling as though they can defeat Daesh without significant Sunni participation. And I think that's incredibly dangerous. We've seen this partly in Tikrit, in which the assault was largely planned by Shiite militias with Iranian support, and many analysts saying that the US was not even told about this assault, that the Iraqi government was not in charge of planning that assault. When you have this sense of kind of nationalist, chauvinist, almost Iraqi groups taking on the security of their country and defense of their areas and believing that they can do it without the full participation of Iraq's Sunni communities, that's when we see a real problem here. Because once you believe that you can defeat Daesh without reaching out to the Sunni community, then suddenly all of these political concessions that the US and the Abadi government have been talking about since Abadi took power suddenly become less important. And Shiite militias don't believe that delivering those concessions is connected to an ultimate defeat of Daesh in Iraq. And I think that's extremely short-sighted. I think these military forces have been swept up in the short-term victories that they have managed to win and are not seeing the larger picture here, which is that when you have Shiite-dominated forces taking Sunni areas, you create more terrorists.
Indeed, because then the Sunnis who would likely side with the Shiite militia victories in defeating Daesh are then compelled to sort of join up with Daesh again. They're between a rock and a hard place.
And it's so difficult to make this argument to Iraqi Shiites because you've got to remember how emotional this is. Now that Iraqi forces have taken most of Tikrit, you have Iraqi Shiite militia leaders going to look for the site of the graves of those Iraqi soldiers who were killed in the Speaker massacre, in which hundreds of Iraqi Shiite soldiers were just shot in cold blood and buried in mass graves. And the video was broadcast all over the world. But when you have these types of forces who are not under the control of the Iraqi army, who aren't under the control of the government, who aren't subordinated to a chain of command, then you can see these militias running riot. And that's the thing that really has to be controlled. And I think that Tikrit has shown that the Iraqi government is well aware of this. The US has said time and time again that if we start seeing revenge massacres, we're making this problem 10 times worse. And I think we've definitely seen fewer revenge attacks in Tikrit than in previous assaults, but it's still not enough.
Does that speak to the U.S. influence? Because I wanted to ask you to characterize U.S.-Iraqi relations, because you had criticized the United States for not stepping up at the political level.
I just think that the Obama administration, this is just one in a long line of foreign policy catastrophes for that administration. You know, the Obama administration has presided over the very slow and very obvious undoing of Iraq's post-Civil War political settlement. You know, all of those checks and balances that the US painstakingly put into place in order to drag Iraq out of civil war were slowly, one by one, undone by the Maliki government. And people like me and other Iraq analysts were again and again drawing attention to it. And the Obama administration could not have been less interested. And they've been dragged into this fight, kicking and screaming, and they're doing the bare minimum. And I think that the Iranians, honestly, the US government has a lot to learn from Iranian engagement in Iraq. You know, you've got to be engaged with individual political leaders. You've got to talk to Shiite political leaders who lead militias, who you disagree with, who you perhaps feel even slightly threatened by. You've got to talk to those people and figure out what it is that they want. Many southern provinces produce Iraq's oil revenues and yet don't see the outcome of those revenues. You know, they have very poor service infrastructures. abysmal education and very, very little investment into those areas that are really the financial soul of Iraq. And there is a lot of anger and bitterness and resentment there. And if the US was prepared to be deeply involved in Iraqi politics and to commit to seeing a real solution instead of just a sticking plaster of airstrikes, I think that there is a lot more that we could achieve diplomatically. But unfortunately, I think this administration has not yet shown the will to be engaged at that level.
And of course, President Obama consistently says that he wants to withdraw from Iraq, both militarily, especially because he knows there's a war weariness in the American public, so he uses this as the pretext. But what you're saying will not require so-called troops on the ground, which he constantly says will not take place. But we are doing these airstrikes, and as you said, they are not sustainable unless a political process is much more invigorated.
Absolutely. And I think the kind of debate that we're seeing in the US about whether airstrikes are enough or whether we need boots on the ground, it's just completely the wrong debate. This is a political problem. The rise of ISIS in Iraq has very clear political roots. And yet we're not doing enough to fix it. And we can introduce leverage into the Iraqi political scene by perhaps using a fraction of the amount of money that we pour into military efforts in that country into supporting economic development and projects in these impoverished Shiite southern regions that could help us to bring the Shiite political leadership on board with the political concessions that we need to achieve. You know, we know how to play politics. You've seen what the American political system is like. I don't know why, when it comes to foreign policy, we think that's it. There's one government, we can only deal with the prime minister, and everything else that happens behind the scenes is not of our concern. That's not what effective diplomacy is.
And of course, as you said, in the vacuum comes Iran with both its political and military influence. And this is, of course, spooking the Persian Gulf states, who are also, in a sense, reacting in a more military way and also disappointed with the lack of United States influence. So, of course, this is snowballing the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the latest intervention that we've seen in Yemen with this just unprecedented group of Sunni states joining together to intervene in a very weak country that has long-running internal problems, suffers from a huge amount of poverty and underinvestment. When you see that level of force assembled to deal with a situation like that, it's got to beg the question of what is it that all these countries think is at stake for them here? And the answer is that they genuinely believe that Iran is spreading its tentacles across the whole of the Arab world and that Iran is actually causing these problems. And I have to say that Iran has not, in many cases, been playing a positive role. But when you believe that Iran is capable of orchestrating unrest across the region simply because it wants to, I mean, that's ludicrous. And it leads to these serious strategic miscalculations about what's going on and about what the solution is. The solution to the problems in Yemen are addressing the long-standing grievances of Yemen's local populations, including the Houthis. But the Houthis aren't alone here. They're allied with former President Saleh's forces, and they're able to mount a successful challenge against the government because that transitional government delivered very, very little in terms of reform. And yet when you see everything in terms of a proxy war between Iran, who's controlling these forces in Yemen and trying to take over Yemen, then of course your solutions are geared towards a fundamental misdiagnosis. And they're not going to fix the problem. They're just going to exacerbate it.
Let me turn now to my colleague Jeff for another question.
You were talking a little bit about the role Iran is playing and the role that the U.S. perhaps should have played, which leads me to ask, can Iran be brought in, given the influence it is wielding, to the extent that it's wielding it in different places, specifically in Iraq? Can Iran be used to play a positive role here? And given the narrative that's developed about the United States as it's pulled back some of its forces and pulled back from engagement in Iraq, is it capable of playing the political role that you deem is necessary? Or are there going to be new obstacles now if the U.S. tries to reinsert itself and provide some of that leverage to make the necessary political reforms in Iraq?
Yeah, well, absolutely, there'll be pushback if and when the US decides to play a significant political role in Iraq, but it can do it. You know, investment speaks. When you're offering things to politicians, they're receptive. You know, and of course, there is a legacy of anti-Americanism in Iraq, and there will be resistance to that. But there's a legacy of anti-Iranianism in Iraq. I mean, Iran and Iraq fought a brutal 8-year war, and the Iranians have managed to overcome a huge amount of anti-Iranian prejudice because they've had things to offer. They've been consistently engaged. They listen to what people want and need, and they deliver. And ultimately, actions speak a lot louder than words in this case. And consistency is also extremely important here. You know, the US just dives in when you're in crisis mode and then you don't have the relationships in place. You don't know the right people. You don't know what people want. You don't understand the setting that you're walking into. But it's not too late. I think the US needs to learn from these mistakes. When you're dealing with terrorism across the world, when you're trying to shore up fragile and weak states, you know, these are not quick fix problems. These are long-term issues that our diplomatic establishment should be geared towards addressing in, you know, 10, 20-year increments, not in six-month rotations, not in terms of our electoral cycles. And I think that's very important. But in terms of bringing Iran in, it's extremely difficult because there is such a divide between the more moderate parts of the Iranian foreign policy establishment, which is what we're seeing on show in these nuclear negotiations, but also the hardcore ideological parts of that establishment that we see in the Revolutionary Guards Force, that we see in the Republican Guard, that actually are involved in supporting military efforts in other countries. I think those forces are extremely dangerous, and I think that cooperating with them is extremely difficult. And I think that the US did the right thing when we decided that we were going to contribute to the effort in Tikrit, because the Iraqi government asked us for airstrikes. We only did so on condition that those Iranian-commanded forces were not participating in that battle. And I think we need to draw a line here. When we are involved in this effort, we need to be pushing those more nefarious parts of the Iranian foreign policy arm out of the situation.
Well, as we close, Nusseibeh Yunus, that leads me to ask you a question. How can we bring the United States into its more positive influence? You say in your paper regarding what the United States can do is that, one, helping create this National Guard, helping promote de-Ba'athification legislation, and then also, you say, enabling the cash-strapped Iraqi government to invest in the Shia parts of Iraq, that the United States could give the Iraqi government direct budget support to invest in infrastructure and social services in southern Iraq. So again, these are not boots on the ground that President Obama and many members of Congress say we will not do. These are, one could argue, not too expensive, but extremely important measures that would yield many, many dividends.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that needs to happen is that the US foreign policy establishment needs to recognize that politics is at the root of this extremism problem, not only in Iraq, but across the Middle East. And the second thing is that that establishment needs to be willing and committed to engaging with political elites in the region to finding the political solutions, and that we need to be able to properly fund and properly back those initiatives that seek to address political grievances on the same scale that we invest in our military reactions to developments in the region. There is such an imbalance between our military response to these threats and our political response to these threats, even though time and time again, counterinsurgency experts have told us that you cannot militarily defeat an insurgency. You have to undermine it through politics. Yet we are not giving our political efforts the level of emphasis, the funding, the support that they need in order to be truly successful.
Nuseiba Yunus is Senior Research Associate at the Project on Middle East Democracy. That's a policy group based here in Washington. Nuseiba, thank you so much for your fabulous insights. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Glenn Von Kallio. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.